I guess we'll go ahead and get started. I'd like to say that Bob Markley needs no introduction, but I can't, and that's actually a good thing, because I see several people in this room that probably have never met him or don't know a thing about him. So I'll go ahead and introduce him very briefly. Robert Markley is a W.D. and Sarah E. Trowbridge Professor of English at the University of Illinois. He is, along with Ron Schleifer, probably two people I know in my field that are really engaged in interdisciplinary work. And that is not merely attaching themselves to other disciplines in the humanities, but are reaching out to the sciences. And his work sort of reflects this in a kind of breathtaking way. I'll just mention a few of his books, although he's on, book number 6 at the moment, and article number 88. But anyway, his first kind of science-y book was called Fallen Languages, Crises of Representation in Newtonian England. And he has, along with, he's edited Virtual Realities and Their Discontents. He's the author of Dying Planet, Mars and Science and the Imagination. Most recently, The Far East and the English Imagination. And his work on climate, what's the title of your?
That's a good question, but it's on climate and culture during the Little Ice Age.
Okay, climate and culture during the Little Ice Age. And your work the work you're presenting from today is taken from that book, or?
Not really.
Not really. Okay, never mind.
I'll explain.
Okay, well, I guess I will turn the floor over to Bob.
Thanks, Rajani, and thanks for inviting me. I'm going to turn the lights off in here so you can see the screen. This is going to be, I've been hanging out with computer scientists and climate scientists enough, so I'm not reading a paper, I'm talking. Scientists get very nervous when English professors stand up there and read papers, as well they should. This is a presentation that came out of a joint NSF-NEH grant that I was a team member on with some of the people who you'll be meeting. This presentation is put together with Michael Simeone, who is the Associate Director for Institute for Computing and the Humanities, Arts, and Social Sciences at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. And so when we get to the regression analyses, I'm going to skip over those very quickly, and I can give you Michael's email. Or I could call him on the phone, one or the other. So this is a project, and I'll explain the genesis of the project and the nature of my collaboration, because I think it does something a bit different from what many people in so-called digital humanities are doing, which are focusing on text-based data mining, which is interesting, I think that's fine, or on forms of social networking. I'm more interested in the scientists I'm working with are all in the visualization lab at NCSA. We're more interested in what computers can do in terms of visual imaging and what they can tell us about resources that we have and what computers can do or supercomputing can do that we can't do with our own unaided vision. That's the pointer. Here we go. Okay, this grant we held for the better part of 2010 and 11, it was in the Digging into Data initiative. Our theme was the authorship-related questions, which I'll talk about a bit. The PI on it was Peter Bache, who has now left the University of Illinois for the National Institute for Standards and Measurement. And among all of the partners in it, we had $300,000, which is a lot less money than it actually sounds like. This Digging into Data program was a joint effort by the National Science Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joint Information Systems Committee in the UK, and the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. And one of the stipulations of the grant was you need to have team partners from at least 3 sites. We left out the Canadians this time around. So we actually had this multiple layer of dealing with collaborators. I'm sorry, there we go. University of Illinois, The National Center for Supercomputing Applications, which is located on the University of Illinois campus, researchers at Michigan State University, and researchers at the University of Sheffield. There were three parts to the grant. We were looking for common algorithms to do new kinds of high computing visual analysis. As you'll see, Michael and I were working on 17th century maps. The Michigan State people were working on a quilt project to identify authorship of quilts. And the University of Sheffield team was working with a colleague of mine in art history at the University of Illinois on medieval manuscripts. So we were looking for common ways of dealing with visual recognition. So these were the overall goals that we were funded for. We had to identify the salient characteristics of two-dimensional images of historical artifacts. So we were doing the 18th century maps. I'm sorry, this seems to have gone off the edge of the screen, which it's not supposed to. Discover the salient characteristics that distinguish artists or artistic traditions, and develop computational tools that can be applied across a range of data, which is what the NSF was interested in, and enable statistical learning vaguely defined about individual and collective authorship, and develop new research questions and protocols to analyze larger data sets. So this was a proof of concept grant, basically. Whoops, let me go back. You can read about the overall collaboration in this article. First Monday is the journal published by the Digital Humanities Collective at MIT. And you can see the basic problem, these two brief quotations. There's so much data out there that it becomes impossible for us to evaluate it manually or simply by eyesight, and that organizing data becomes a paramount challenge. And that computational tools are not self-generated. You indeed have to write, I think this might be the wrong rough draft version of this, which I apologize for. But they required combined work of humanists and scientists with different disciplinary approaches to produce viable research methodologies and ways of teaching. So we were given a set of parameters that are not ones that I necessarily would have chosen on my own. The authorship-related question was basically a way for us to get our feet in the front door to ask questions about maps in the 17th and 18th century. Why are these important? Well, you can see that there are, in a sense, four researchers working on this project. Peter Bache, the PI, has unfortunately left Illinois, and his GRA, Tenzing Shaw, is the one who actually developed the algorithms that will be that I'll be talking about today. But what you'll see is that we tried to find ways to come up with a computational means to compare what seemed to be fairly random versions of maps of the Great Lakes in the 17th and 18th century. Let me just say a little bit about 17th and 18th century maps. They're very pretty to look at. They're treated as artistic objects by art historians. They seem to hold, for many of us, limited cartographic information that we can be applied today. So when you look at these two widely different views of Lake Huron, and we'll be talking about Manitoulin Island up here, which is here represented as a chain of islands. When we look at these maps, our initial reaction is, oh, that's beautiful. And our second reaction tends to be, oh, how wrong they got it, how funny it is. It doesn't look anything like Lake Huron. These folks had to be idiots, or they were just making stuff up without any data. And what I had found in my work, dating back to my previous book on the Pacific Ocean, was that mapping technologies seem to be very difficult, excuse me, tail end of the comp, seemed to be very difficult to categorize in terms of progress towards a more scientific understanding of various regions of the Earth. And so we weren't necessarily trying to distinguish between French and English artistic traditions, although that was the overall framework of the grant. What we were more interested in doing is finding out how cartography changed over time. And we need to remember that the Great Lakes were of vast strategic importance in the 18th century, particularly in the 1750s and 60s, when wars were fought between the French and the English. And what we are looking at when we're looking at Lake Huron are critically important trade routes, particularly for the fur trade in the 18th century. Now, I'd like you to look at some of the maps. This is going to be, I'm going to flip through some examples over this period. This is Lee's map from 1685. Now you can see this is not designed as a pretty picture to look at. This is crammed with, excuse me, all sorts of details. You'll notice that there are efforts to map in exaggerated fashion rivers that feed into the Great Lakes. There are efforts to identify forts, to identify mountainous regions, to identify fording places. So this map for somebody in 1685 has a great deal of use value rather than aesthetic value. Note particularly the shape of Lake Huron, which we'll come back to. This does not look like Lake Huron does on maps today. Hennepin's map, French map, from 1701. Now you'll notice that there are significant differences between the British map and the French map. These are not artistic. You can see that Hennepin and his collaborators are making, you know, a good faith effort to get as much information, including the various tribes in the region, onto one map. There are characteristics which we'll look at of exaggerated connections between lakes, kind of mystical islands in the middle of Lake Michigan, on Lake Superior, that are intending to convey information for traders, for explorers, for fur trappers. Let's look at a slightly later map. This is the fabled French and Indian War map of 1759. And again, this is actually seems to be French-Canadian. We're not sure of that. You can see there are efforts there to distinguish, you know, a political boundary between British and French territory. You'll notice that the lake shapes begin to resemble something that's closer to what we would think of as Lake Michigan today. But again, there's this bizarre map of Lake Huron, which we'll come back to. And you'll notice this elongated and enlarged waterway to Lake Erie. Lake Erie is too long and thin, and Ontario is too squat. Now, again, this was a map that was produced during the conflicts between the British and French. It is a strategic map, clearly concerned with indigenous allies of the French, and also with mapping accurately where these tribes are. And the Crow Indians there. And waterways by which you can communicate with the interior. Carey's map in 1806. Now here's the basic problem that we confront with this project. This map in many ways looks less accurate in scare quotes than the maps we just looked at. Look, for example, at how elongated Lake Michigan becomes here. Look, for example, at the weird shape of Lake Huron, and what I'll be talking about later, is notice that Manitoulin Island has been broken up into a chain of islands. 1806, steamboats, 1806, the United States is a country. It's not just a random collection of colonies. And so if we wanted to plot a progressive history of map making, we would think that something like this, with its obvious inaccuracy from our 21st century perspective, would be an outlier, that there would be something wrong, that whoever drew this map was incompetent. And that's the question that we were investigating. Now, we quickly recognized, and because I work on climate change, that the differences in shapes of lakes and the differences in depictions of islands may well be reflecting actual material conditions on the ground and actual ambiguities that we forget about in terms of cartography. This is the water depth in meters in the Great Lakes today. This is Manitoulin Island that we'll look at here. And you can see that this passage in the northern lobe of Lake Huron, which was an extremely important trade route, is very shallow, less than 20 meters in depth. Historically, we know that the level of the Great Lakes have varied over time. If you work in historical climatology, you will quickly realize that although there's a kind of boilerplate benchmark of middle of the 19th century for instrumentation measurements of temperature and so on, that in reality, measurements well into the latter half of the 19th century are not really trustworthy. So that means when we're talking about climate change, over, say, the last 300 or 500 or 1,000 years, we actually have to rely on what scientists call proxy data, tree rings, coral growth, sediments and bogs, to determine what climatological conditions are at any given place. And indeed, there are groups of scientists working on bogs in Canada. However, what those kinds of studies indicate tend to be general patterns over fairly wide areas. And so what we lack often in the historical record is an understanding of what a 1 foot or 2 foot or 3 foot variation in lake levels in the Great Lake region means. We are working with climatologists at the University of Illinois in the School of Earth Science and Environment, who are actually interested in this demonstration project, because it turns out that when you run simulations today, the level of water in the Great Lakes has enormous consequences for the climate of the Midwestern part of the country. And that if you vary lake levels, or vary levels in lakes, you can produce fairly wide ranges going out 30 and 40 years in what the climate of the Midwest will look like, which concerns us all, even if we don't live in Illinois, because of growing seasons, drought, flooding, all sorts of problems that we associate with climate change. So the initial objectives in the grant proposal were to figure out some way to compare all those maps we just looked at. The question that I wanted to ask about climatology is not something that I can simply go to a computer scientist and say, okay, you do this for me. We had to figure out a way that we could get some kind of computational specificity out of the 40 maps in our original data set. Okay. What we decided on that was computationally doable was to create a means to determine the surface area of irregular shapes of the Great Lakes on maps. So, while we might not be able to compare Lake Huron in this map to Lake Huron in that map in great detail, what we could do is calculate the square mileage of this. Then we wanted to use the newly generated data to determine how much knowledge sharing there existed between French and British cartographers, and ascertain if there was any unique knowledge specific to regions of the lakes that were encoded in national cartographic traditions. So this is how we were fitting in to this authorship question, British traditions versus French traditions. Okay, reasonably interesting. These are the forms of knowledge that the maps basically encode. Okay? Accounts, sketches. Map makers, of course, are interested in producing accurate maps to integrate multiple sources. As we'll see, there's scale bars, which help to locate precisely accurate geospatial representation. But this was our key kind of working hypothesis. If climatological conditions shift over time, they can produce seemingly erratic representations of coastlines and islands. So we had to consider all sorts of scientific and technological considerations. Okay, you can see these here. There was no formal survey of the Great Lake region until 1820. So before then, we're relying on hand sketches, accounts, and rather primitive instrumentation. There were no chronometers taken into the Great Lakes, as far as we can tell, at any point in the 18th century, although they were used to determine longitude at sea. So, with some exceptions, cartographic representations improve over time. You can kind of get a sense looking at Lake Erie from here to here, to Cary, to Arrowsmith in 1817, just before steamship travel becomes commonplace on the lakes. And there's a satellite image from 2004. As our second point indicates, you'll notice that the waterways between lakes are exaggerated. And the reason for that seems to be these are optimistic renditions of how easy it is to get from the lake to the next lake, okay, trade routes. So when you look at these, look at these waterways on the map, and you can compare it today, well, the waterway may conceivably have been wider then, you can see that this is creating, as the 1685 map does, the image of a much wider channel, a 10-12 mile wide channel that can easily get you further up into the Great Lakes and facilitate trade and colonization. Here we can see what these waterways look like in detail, and you'll notice that considering what they had to work with, these are not bad, renditions. You basically had to sail around the edge of the lake, or you had to walk around the edge of the lake. And so you're doing this in a kind of very hands-on sort of way. Even in Lake Erie, which is relatively accurately drawn, you can see that in the 18th century, there's a group of three islands that are figured in this kind of protruding bay in the southwest corner of the lake, which you don't see on the map today. But what the satellite image does show, as you can tell, are very shallow water areas. And if lake levels are varying, and they can vary for a number of reasons, this map may not be a figment of some cartographer or explorer's imagination. We may actually have been looking at a different sort of geographical and hydrological situation in the 18th century. Now, how did we set about doing this? Okay, this is why you need to collaborate if you're a humanist with scientists. Right? I do not get paid to computer code. Right? It's not worth the university's money for me to learn how to, well, and can do a little bit of coding. But it's not worth it for me to sit down and try to reproduce that labor as part of my research project. So what we developed, or what Tenzing Shaw, the graduate student working on this, developed, was what's called a segmentation algorithms and a workflow. So workflow simply means algorithms acting in succession. First, we had to isolate the shape of each lake in order to determine lakes from land masses. We had to teach the computer to do that. Secondly, teach the software to do that. Then determine the scale of each map by the neat lines and determine a ratio of pixel degrees of latitude. And then come up with an algorithm that would count the pixels within identified shapes and then calculate the surface area. So really, what I refer to this as is the bouncing ball algorithm, which it will demonstrate, okay? First of all, you have to teach the, you have to teach a computer to recognize that this is a border between land and water, but so is this, and so are these, which turns out to be hard to do. And the algorithm that Tenzing developed basically sent this kind of bouncing ball hundreds of thousands of times within the outlines of the lake to create an accurate measurement of the surface area of the lake. One of the things that we have to do in the next stage is figure out what happened in a situation like this. Theoretically, we actually are distinguishing land from water there, but as you can see, it's hard to do. You also have to teach the algorithm that this is not a land mass, that this is writing, and that this is writing. So it was a complicated process, which you can't do. This is why you need a supercomputer, okay? This is why you need high-performance computing. There's no way to calculate this. You get your ruler and protractor out, you will be in a padded cell in very short order. This is what's called a neat line at the bottom of the map, okay? And it's a scale of degrees of latitude. This is Mackenzie from 1801. And what this allows a computer to do is convert pixels to degrees of latitude, to fractions of degrees of latitude, which gives you a measure so that you can count the pixels within the cutout shape of Lake Erie or Lake Michigan, right? So we needed this. But then you have to teach the computer to distinguish, what this mark signifies, what that mark signifies, what the scale is, and so on. So that was the second stage in the workflow. What this would allow us to produce is a cutout or mask. Whoops. Sorry. A cutout or mask of the lake, which then could be measured. The next stage that we couldn't accomplish is not only to increase the data set to far more maps, but to be able to segment off parts of lakes so that we can draw an artificial line here and then just have the program calculate the square area in there.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Yeah. So that image results from applying the computer algorithm workflow to that map?
Right.
So those little places where it looks like they're peninsulas, is that where the computer still can't distinguish between handwriting? Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
Well, it's yes. This is, it's very, you can see that here's where your problem is.
Yeah.
I think that this is a relatively low quality resolution blown up version of this image. The map is much smaller. And this is actually more accurate than you would think looking at this map.
Okay.
At least that's what we decided. I mean, there are limitations to what the algorithm could do and not do. Because technically, what you have to do is create sort of as I call it, bouncing ball, something that won't go up these rivers, something that's bigger than the pixels that it's counting. So that seemed to be a problem solved. I'm not going to, this is the regression analysis, and basically what it shows, you can see the British maps are in blue, you can see the French are in red. I think that what the regression analysis shows is that there's a clustering of measurements of the square mileage of the lake which cluster in this triangle here, or this rectangle here over time. This is the actual square mileage of the lake as we understand it today. But we're in a kind of Benoit-Mandelbrot, how long is the coast of England problem. This is what we get from satellite data today. So one of the things that you can see is that the bizarre outliers in all of these mapping traditions, and all the maps generally get more accurate over time, there are still maps into the 19th century which are wildly inaccurate, even though there are other accurate maps being drawn at the same time. Lake Erie, for some reason, the French consistently treated Lake Erie as though it was a river. These long, narrow shapes of Lake Erie. The British tended to be much more accurate. The ones I wanted is Lake Michigan. The two I wanted to call your attention to is where there's less accuracy over time, Lake Superior. The British were tended to be more accurate than the French. This is probably some Frenchman thinking he's found the Northwest Passage. I mean, again, you look at the square mileage of the lake, and you can see they're off by orders of magnitude. But the really interesting one is Lake Huron, in terms of just square mileage, because you can see that there's not, with this, particularly these maps down here, all clustering after 1800 demonstrate, there's not a vast improvement in terms of determining the size of Lake Huron, which the British and French traveled through continually. So, how can we account for that? Go back one. Well, the horizontal patterns indicate moments where we suspect knowledge is shared from one cartographer to the next. That is, if you're doing a map here, you may have the French map or the English map there. Okay. There are linear improvements in the mapping for some regions, as we just showed, Lake Ontario, but not for others. And there's no meta-argument to explain the variations in the representation of Lake Superior and Huron. It's not that they were less explored. It's not that there were fewer people traipsing through them. It's not that there were, fewer tribes they were engaged with. So these were our kind of initial hypotheses being modified in terms of what we determined there. Sorry. Okay. Climatological variables and cartography. There's a socio-political thesis that could come out of the mapping. And I think this is what many historians who we talked to, or at least some of the historians, wanted to go for. Unstable political control of the region, the so-called French and Indian War, 1757 to 63, different trading routes, changing relationships with various tribes, differential knowledges of the lakes. So then, in a sense, you could, for example, be cut off from access to an area of a lake for 10 or 15, 20 years if you were a British explorer or cartographer, and therefore you wouldn't have accurate information. But wait. We're not going to get the NSF to give us more money for that. The climatological thesis that ice cover, changing lake levels, and the difficulties of distinguishing between ice and land, water and wetlands and so-called salt land contribute to the extreme surface inconsistencies of Lake Huron and Superior, despite technological improvements in instrumentations over the course of the 18th century. Okay. We've begun to look at accounts of explorers and traders from the 18th into the 19th century, 1816. Okay. On June 2nd, I left Lake Huron, still covered with ice, for several miles from shore. Now, the region we're going to be talking about, as I said, is Manitoulin Island. This is 1816. Now, this is all right. This is cold, right? It's colder than Texas up here, but you do not find ice covering any of the Great Lakes in June. Now, we need to remember that during this period, we're still in the so-called Little Ice Age, which, at least in North America, the eastern half of North America, and in Europe, temperatures were, on average, about a centigrade degree cooler than they are in the period 1920 to 1960. And so one of the things that we're hypothesizing is that the normative conditions of the lakes in the Little Ice Age were much more like what we would consider terrible winters today when ice covers the lake. There are also obvious other factors involved, such as damming up of streams, pollutants which tend to be warmer flowing into the lakes. After all, I live near Chicago. But you can see that you could not leave. This is, by the way, whoops, I'm sorry about that. Keep hitting the wrong button. If you can see this arrow over here, this is where Wingfield is writing from. This is where he's leaving the northern lobe of the lake. This is still an ice-covered area for several miles from shore. This is an ice cover map in northern Huron from a very harsh winter in 1989. This is for April 10th. Now, this is the percentage of ice cover. And you can see the darker areas mean more ice coverage. So you can see that the northern regions of Huron here are 95-96% covered with ice in April of 1989. And you can see that there were significant ice that actually disrupted shipping on Superior during this same time. And you can see that there are parts of Lake Huron which are effectively iced in. Now, I think that this is critical. I mean, if we're down here in Chicago, we're looking out on Lake Michigan, it looks like Lake Michigan normally does. But as you go north, you have a situation, particularly around Manitoulin Island. There are people actually walking from Canada to Manitoulin Island, apparently, during this harsh winter. Remember, we've only had satellite Landsat coverage of our climate for a relatively short period of time, a blip of the eye in climatological terms, and even in historical terms. When I was born, there were no satellite images of the Earth. So this gives us some sense of what the conditions may have been like for somebody trying to map the region in the early 19th century. This is ice cover from a NASA satellite of Manitoulin Island, which you can, barely see here. You'll notice that the northern lobe of Lake Huron is practically covered with ice, and you can see the ice along the coasts there. So, if you're in a canoe, if you're you've got a very short trading season, to get to Lake Superior and trade for furs there, you don't have time to sit around and drill ice cores. You don't have time to, engage in lengthy discussion with other traders or with members of various indigenous tribes about what weather conditions are like. So that you can see, even in the 21st century, you can get significant ice cover, which is going to have knock-on effects in terms of how you represent the region. Now, let's look at these maps again. Satellite image here, 2004, ice cover. Well, look at what happens, three maps within a 20-year period. Manitoulin Island is drawn by Carey reasonably accurately as a single island. Now, as you can see, this image is a little dark, Manitoulin Island is cut by all sorts of bays and waterways in through these regions. This is very low-lying land, fertile but low-lying land. Look at Russell in 1801. Manitoulin Island has deconstructed itself into a chain of islands. And Arrowsmith in 1814, same thing. Not a single island, as we see here, cut by bays and inlets, but a chain of islands. Well, what's our explanation for this? Well, one explanation is good cartography versus bad cartography, right? That's always possible. One is good information versus bad information. But it doesn't take a great deal of stretch of the imagination to think that one of several things is happening here. Are we looking at wetlands here, which are being described as solid land or visualized as solid land, at a time when the lake levels may have been comparatively cooler? Okay, that is, cooler lake levels, more ice freezes out, more dry land is exposed. Whereas here, if this is being drawn from data in the summer of 1800 or 1799, warm weather could cause flooding along here. Same thing here. We don't seem to have wetlands anymore in the United States very much, but it's a significant problem. How do you map a swamp? Is a swamp that you can wade through solid land, or is it water? If you're in, if you're in hip boots fly fishing in the spring, do you know that you're standing in water, or do you think that you're standing on what will appear to be solid land at some other point of the season? So this is our best guess assumption about what may be going on, because otherwise you've got, just kind of random variations, both in the size of the lake and the shape of the lake, which are very hard to account for. Because these are all reputable cartographers. Arrowsmith is in all English geography books in the early 19th century. So I believe, if I remember correctly, Jane Austen's family had a copy of Arrowsmith's geographies. So this is what, Jane Austen is sitting down to look at while she's writing Persuasion. That's the map of Lake Huron. What's really interesting is that over time, there doesn't seem to be any improvement. In terms of quote-unquote modern mapping and accuracy, the size of Lake Huron is quote-unquote inaccurate here, but Manitoulin Island looks very much like what we would recognize as Manitoulin Island today. Morse, 1822, there's steamships beginning to show up on the Great Lakes by 1822. Manitoulin Island has disappeared into this chain of islands, although the shape of Lake Huron is, in terms of square mileage and also just our intuitive sense of what the lake looks like, is more accurately drawn than here. But yet you have this otherwise very difficult to account for disintegration of Manitoulin Island into this chain of islands.
Quick question, because I'm having a little trouble with the scale here. How much do you need to raise the lake level to break it up, the island, into a series of chains?
That is a great question, and there's not a good answer for that, because the data on lake levels prior to the mid-19th century is pretty poor. We can see six to 7 feet changes in lake levels historically, okay. is just in records going back 200 years.
But if you've got DEM models of the island itself, you should know the topography of it.
Right.
And so what are the low spots that if you raise the lake level 1 foot would become creeks running through it?
If we look at this here, a lot of what seems to be solid coastline are actually wetlands, or still wetlands. So that's the problem. I mean, there is a subjective element to this. It's very possible to be standing on solid ground, looking out at a wetlands, looking out at acres of lily pads, for example, and rendering that in different kinds of ways. Now, in when we originally started doing this, I wanted to, this project, we may get around to it, I wanted to work with maps of China, because Chinese cartographers are generally better through the mid-19th century than their Western counterparts. And they actually have symbols for salt marshes, for freshwater marshes, and for other kinds of, and for canals, for non-natural waterways. So if you look at 17th and 18th century maps of China, we'll see large areas, the Pearl River Delta, which are drawn as marsh, which in a sense means oftentimes they're navigable by boat at certain times of the year, but not at others. So part of the problem here is Manitouan Island also is all farms. And topsoil has been dragged in large areas. So it's hard to tell what the island, quote-unquote, looked like. We've gone back to look at 19th century accounts and journals. We have, for example, Wingfield's account. There are other French explorers' accounts, which tell us a little bit about this. But, you know, if you talk to any farmer, because we do this, the Agricultural Survey of Illinois does this fairly frequently, you know, they'll remember what they did to the land, but they'll have no idea often if their grandfather or their father or the previous owner dredged a pond, for example, or deepened a pond, or if the pond's even artificial or not. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you. And actually, while we're on scale, can I ask you one more?
Sure, quick? Yeah.
Back up one.
Okay.
How rapidly are lake levels changing? And can you get a change from 1796 to the summer of 1799 of enough vertical throw of your lake that you can turn an island into a series of Lukani islands?
That's a great question. And the problem is complicated by this, ice. And the problem is if a wetlands ice is over, which we're unused to, I mean, obviously it's not going to happen in Texas, right? If this, there's a question of how far you can walk out on the ice and how solid the ice is. There were only 3 months to get to Lake Superior and trade and get back. You had 3 months. And in the age before steamships, this was really, really tough. Once you had steamships, Margaret Fuller goes on a tour of the Great Lakes in the 1840s, and you know, it's very easy to do. Prior to that, people are racing. You know, my guess is that, and you can see that there are actually good faith efforts here to indicate water depths. You can see the shaded area there, which is a map convention.
I brought the wrong glasses. I can't see
okay.
anything.
Okay. Well, okay.
I'll take your word for it, though.
Yeah, you see that
okay.
blurry part next to the blurry part? Yeah.
You're right. That blurry part next to the blurry part. You know, we were talking to Don Wobbles, who heads our climate, our Center for Climate Change at Illinois, and he said, you know, nobody has ever asked this question before, is how much of a lake level rise would you need? And then, you know, we know that in the 19th century, there was a fair amount of dredging that went on. So that some of these kind of weird little islands that don't really seem to exist today may have been sandbars. Who's using the map? People walking along the shore or people who are actually on the water. And the Great Lakes are very treacherous waters to navigate. So there's another question. Or is this, you know, are these chains of islands here islands, or you can see it better here, are these islands? Are they sandbars?
They're islands.
Yeah.
They're granite.
Granite.
They're
okay.
granite, yeah. Because the difference between the North Shore of Georgian Bay
right.
is in the Canadian Shield.
Right.
And Manitoulin is like the Bruce Peninsula in Michigan. It's
right.
it's south, and so it's softer. But, I mean, I've spent 50 years on Lake Huron.
Yeah.
And I've seen the water levels change. I mean, it's
how
4
much?
Feet lower now than
right.
it was 35 years
okay.
ago. And I've seen islands...
4 feet.
I've seen islands that... like a single island. There's one very close to where I go, that's essentially one island joined by a kind of an isthmus.
Yeah.
It's about 4 feet out of the water these days. And most of the time when I was a kid, on the maps, it was one island.
Right.
But it was two islands in reality, and you could canoe with right over.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've seen plenty of islands that, for years, they didn't exist, and now there are islands there. They're definitely there.
I think you're hired, Chris, as a consultant.
Even in the, until radar, navigating on you go from, say, Collingwood in the southern part of, on the other side of the Bruce Peninsula, down in there, up the Georgian Bay coast towards the French River, beyond it, you were going up in those channels to Lake Superior, it was incredibly treacherous.
Yes.
Because it's called the 30,000 islands, but there's actually millions of islands, and that's not counting the islands that in certain seasons
are
granite, and it's just a foot or two below water.
When I gave a presentation of this in Maine, and they said there were analogous problems with charting the Maine coast.
It's very much like the Maine coast. It's very much like Finland.
Yeah. So that you can't really, you can look at maps of Maine that look identical, but they're actually, the number of islands will vary from 100 to 10,000 over a period of like 30 years in terms of mapping because it's sea levels. So the water levels, I think, we can say that the change in water levels in the Great Lakes seems to be, man-made these days. But also if reflecting temperatures, but, 1801, could this be a warm spring with flood water, sure, versus this,
Just have one question related to the water level and ice. Geography and climatology are my Achilles heels, so maybe my question will end that. But I'm wondering if you've got this algorithm that can calculate the surface area of these lakes as they're represented in the maps, would there be any benefit to doing something like an analysis of variance to compare the size of the island in each map to the overall size of the lake to
see how that's related? One of the things that we could do is precisely that. Originally, I was thinking of an algorithm that would measure the coastlines of islands. And what we ran into was a critical problem, is that relatively few maps are digitized, and that we decided that we couldn't afford on the grant to pay for maps. So we went with maps that the University of Illinois had that had already been digitized. Illinois, Great Lakes. So that was part of our decision making. We now have access to a private map collection, the David Rumsey collection. If you've never seen this, you should check it out online. It's absolutely amazing. This guy is a real estate billionaire and buys maps the way that, normal human beings might buy tennis balls or something. One gets a little flat. He has thousands of maps online. So our next stage of the project, to get a larger data set, we will be able to do, those sorts of things. Computer time is not cheap. Yeah.
I was wondering, over the years, that there might be strategic reasons for mapping them differently, like periods during which you could sail close to one coastline or could not sail close to one coastline.
By this time,
tales has been like Chris is telling.
For complicated reasons, this seems to have been the basic trading route was to go north of Manitoulin. I think primarily to stay out of storms on the Great Lakes.
Chris is suggesting though that that's a very treacherous.
Well, but by canoe, they would have hugged
the shore,
the shore, the all the way up, using the islands as barriers for the westerlies.
Right.
And steamboats later followed some of the same paths, but it depended on what they were doing. But because of all the towns, so for logging and mining and everything, they had to follow the same sort of route, but it's very easy in a canoe.
Right.
So, but you know, it's treacherous in a steamboat.
In a steamboat, it's treacherous, and also you can't really canoe across Lake Huron or Lake Michigan. I mean, you know, it sounds crazy to us, but when you see these for the first time, they're not lakes; they're inland seas.
Yeah.
They have big storms on them. You all know the Gordon Lightfoot song "Wreck at the Edmund Fitzgerald." That's 1975. You know that the ship went down. So, you know, your choice was to go north or to hug the coastline south, and north seems to have been the favored route.
I'm going
to
show you where they went.
All right.
Well, this might be.
Okay, so they didn't use this at all.
What?
It's not on the map. Here we've got, we can see part of Lake Ontario here, maybe. But there was a series of lakes that went this way up into Lake Simcoe and then into Georgia Bay, and then they hugged the coastline.
Yeah.
And they went this way. And from Montreal, actually, they went up the Ottawa River from the St. Lawrence and then across through a series of rivers into Lake Nipissing and then down the French River. And so they go this way. So if you had a map of Canada for the fur trade, here, Montreal is almost due west from here. And so they didn't bother going down this way. But it was also, you couldn't canoe across just because the lake is so dangerous.
Yeah, you know, thanks a lot for that. And also, you know, I appreciate that. That was our sense. We can follow Wingfield's journey. And, you know, because of the winds on the lakes, you know, they would go no more than 4 or 5 miles a day, oftentimes. And so it really was a race, you know, to get into Lake Superior and the richer trading grounds. Oops. Here we go. Well, that's the one we were looking at. The Franquelin in 1685 and Morse in 1822. Which is, you know, and Morse is a pretty good cartographer. And you can see there's great kind of socio-political detail.
You can see the canoe route right there.
Which
route? Rice Lake and all that series of lakes.
Yeah,
that's the way they went.
Yeah. Yeah. You can see these, and you can see that the, you know, they're actually cities now, in the area. They're very careful to show you where tribes are. They show the waterways that Chris was talking about a moment ago. And yet, you know, there's this fundamental problem as you look at it with Manitoulin Island in terms of how you deal with it. There we go. So, you know, these are the, this is where we are now in terms of writing a new grant. The French were able to do a better job, probably because they controlled the area, of ascertaining the shape of the lands in northern Huron. And they may have had a better sense of seasonal variations in land and water. The French actually seem, or at least some French traders, wintered on the coast of the Great Lakes, and the English tended not to do that. The inconsistencies in surface area across the data set are indicative probably of changing environmental conditions, and we'll need to increase the size of the data set to ascertain those. And the other critical question is to do a full-scale analysis of what temperature data we do have for the upper Midwest, or the old Northwest, as we call it, during the Little Ice Age. We want to look at maps in the wake of the 1815 Mount Tambora eruption, the so-called year without the...
Yeah, I was thinking of that because you had that account of the guys talking about, was it June, and the ice hasn't gone out, and that was the summer of 1816.
Exactly.
And the water never got warm
the
previous summer, so it would have been extra cold the next winter and into the next summer.
And 1817 as well,
And, but that
there, that's a really cool piece of information,
yeah,
because you were talking about the effects of the lake on climate.
Right.
So the water is still colder than normal 2 years after.
Yes.
So the delayed reaction. So in any season where you have a warmer than usual summer, that's the effects are going to be felt for a couple of years and vice versa.
Check your snowfall records for Buffalo. If you start freezing your lakes, you're going to reduce your precipitation.
That would be interesting. I mean, it turns out that the data well into the mid-19th century for the Great Lakes is not really, really good. For example, Chicago and Milwaukee have basically been rebuilt over time. So, you know, if you go to New York, you can do kind of urban archaeology, which you can't do on the Chicago, on the coast of Lake Michigan, because everything's been dredged, piled up, built over, and so on. We've looked at Margaret Fuller's 1844 Summer on the Lakes, which is about her travels a couple summers earlier. And it's actually very interesting to see the lack of precision in her descriptions of the coastline. She's much more concerned with the indigenous tribes and their plight, but it's very hard, unless you're looking at fur traders or at military expeditions, to figure out specific climatological conditions in any given year. So, any other questions or anything anyone want to ask?
Well, I find this completely fascinating, and I want to, in some ways, go back to the issue that I'm kind of familiar with, which is the issue of borders, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what distinguishes wetlands from wet, from water, ice from water, you know, all of these kinds of boundaries that you know, lend themselves to solidify things into real hard truths,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, like,
right.
This is land, that's water. Those things seem to be completely separate. And so I'm just wondering what, you know, in this effort to really quantify and using all these different methodologies and all of these different disciplinary approaches, what kinds of implications is, what kinds of epistemological implications does
well,
this have? You know,
one is, just think about our assumptions about what this line means, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, this reifies conditions in 1685.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the coast of Lake Huron was in 1865. You know, and one could argue, of course, that this is in turn is a historically specific artifact, not a universal
mm-hmm.
kind of truth, because lake levels, as Chris was talking about, are changing all the time. The second kind of epistemological question, and I think we have to, you know, consider, is what the significance of specific kinds of details, you know, of rivers drawn here, which, you know, in this, excuse me, in a sense, don't show up really on a map today. What do they indicate? My interest in waterways is that, until very, very recently, water was the primary mode, not only of travel, but of communication. That to get information from one point to another, one was traveling by water. And that's a very alien mindset, I think, for those of us living in the 21st century. I think a third set of kind of epistemological questions has to do with you know, questions of ice cover, and obviously questions of climate change as we consider it, you know, today. And the fact is, it's very expensive to run a climatological model. It uses up immense amounts of supercomputing time. So if you wanted to do a limited run to look at what the temperature of Chicago is going to be like over the next 50 years, even if you restricted it to Chicago, even if all the scientific work was done, it would cost you about $50,000 just in terms of computer time, supercomputer time to run the simulation. But I think one of the questions of the that future simulations raises, what happens if there are varying changes in lake levels and various changes in ice cover. To go back to Chris's point about Montambora, you know, we could be sitting here right now and Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines could be erupting again. Or we could get a massive volcanic eruption that throws a lot of volcanic ash into the atmosphere. And as in 1816, 1815, radically altered the worldwide climate, leading to ice cover on Lake Huron in June of 1816, but having enormous knock-on effects for our climate today. So
in other words, we could also reread Emma, right?
Yeah. Written in 1815, 1816. You could reread. Yeah, and I think that, you know, it also raises a question of what we consider normative temperatures. At any given, or normative climate conditions at any given time. And, you know, I mean, there's pretty good evidence, I mean, coming particularly from the Hadley Center in England, that when Jane Austen was walking around, the climate of southeastern England and central England was much, much different from what we experience today. Where, you know, a hot day in summer would be 60 degrees Fahrenheit at that time.
I have a big question like hers as well, like Roger is.
This demonstration. Speak up, Ron.
Sure, I'm sorry. The demonstration gives me a good sense of what we in the humanities who are interested in representation can gain from the sciences. What can the sciences gain from our work in a project like this?
Well, okay. Here's the way that you're all familiar with Michael Mann's hockey stick that shows the rapid rise in temperature in the 20th century. Okay. You know, the fact is there's very little climatological data prior to the end of the 19th century that's reliable. So what we're using are best guess estimates, right? And what we've talked about is, I've asked Don Wobble this, we've asked him point blank, if we take this, and it's a question of the lake rise level, it's a question of, you know, particularly harsh winters than document, could there be information that we could extract? I mean, let's suppose that these cartographers are actually doing their jobs, which I have every, you know, confidence that they were. I mean, this was high tech in 1816. We may be able to provide more data points, scattered data points, from cartographic information, which would then render our ideas of climate change over the last 200 or 300 years more accurate. So the scientists actually think that they may be able to generate usable data if we can get a large enough data set of maps. There's a great point that, now his name escapes me. My brain is stuck in a little ice age momentarily. There's a great point that, you know, today scientists are inundated with data, all right? So when you're downloading climatological data today, or if you're downloading data, classic example would be from the Mars rovers, it takes decades to sift through that, all right? It's just too much information. And then actually, from a mathematical modeling point of view, being able to pinpoint data from the past without, you know, thousands of extraneous variables that need new computer programs to generate may actually be more useful, considering that we're dealing with approximations anyhow. So there's actual science, there's a computer science aspect about the algorithms that were written for this. They're going to appear, you know, we wrote this algorithm in an article in a technical computer science engineering journal. But we think that we might be able to, looking at Rumsey's map collection, get to a point where we could at least suggest refinements in kind of baseline values, which then might produce more accurate kind of modeling. And I mean, you know, in terms of living in the Midwest, there are hundreds of billions of dollars riding on, you know, minute differentials in temperature, wind, humidity, changes, you know, over time. So they do think they can get some data out of this, at least potentially, or it's worth exploring. Sure.
Okay, so speaking as a, well, I'm a physicist, so what do I know about earth science? But speaking in general as a scientist, I would look at this, something like this, and think, and maybe, David, maybe you can answer this. If there was really ice covering that island at the time, are there any proxies one can use by excavating the island to right. see what was the, what in what form was the water at a given depth in the soil? Was it liquid water on top of that soil, solid water on top of that soil, or dry, in which case you'd just be getting precipitation, presumably? And on those kinds of short time scales, right? Because you can use deuterium levels in ice cores from Antarctica.
Right.
But that there you're talking about thousands and thousands of years that you're mapping climate using right. that. Here we're talking about tens of
years.
This
is all a scalar issue.
Yeah.
And ultimately, when we're talking about climate, we're not talking about a three-year lesson of Pinatubo cooling yeah. things. That's just right. That's just weather.
That's right.
Yeah. Right. In this instance, in answer to your question, I don't know if you get anything out of the sediment, but there are all manner of proxy records that are high-resolution records
okay.
that you yeah. could use, because ultimately, I think the control on this is not how cold the winter is, it's how hot
the summer is. Mm-hmm. Always
and
summer.
How much of that
yeah.
snow are you melting, and how much is dumping right. into the lakes?
Right.
And we've got, I think, good records, proxy records that can give you at least an approximate figure, but at the scale of resolution that you're talking about
yeah.
here, going from 1796 to the summer of 1799, mm-hmm. Might be a little more problematic.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a terrific point. I mean, the question is, you know, over a 100 or 150 year time period that we're looking at here, are there kind of demonstrable changes? And I think what we might be looking at, okay, I'm reproducing my colleague's viewpoint. You know, there's a question of basically half a degree centigrade. I mean, we know that the Great Lakes region was much cooler in the 19th century. That's a given. The question is, how much cooler? And my understanding is that they've been working with Canadian researchers to get various kinds of proxy data. The proxy data often doesn't line up. The research team at Illinois is basically trying to develop, using the petaflop scale computing, and it in effect makes the sort of pixels for climate prediction smaller and smaller. So today when you look at a climate model, you know, if you say what the climate is of New York is going to be like in 2080, you're using a very large, you know, sort of a geographic square, up to close to 200 miles. And, you know, as we all know, weather can change very dramatically. If you look at, you know, if you look at this map, for example, if we go back to, you know, this map of ice cover, you know, 20 or 30 miles can make a huge difference in how you perceive the winter. And, you know, clearly the question, this is April 10th, 1989, I haven't looked at, how long did this ice persist in Superior? Was this still there on May 10th, on June 10th? And what kind of effects would, you know, would that potentially have?
Weather is a result, at least in part, of climate, but weather
yeah.
can also obscure
right.
climate.
Exactly.
You may not
exactly.
understand how the climate is changing
right.
if all you focus on is the
right.
blurry edges of what the weather's doing.
Right.
When I interviewed for my position here, I was walking down to see the Meadows Museum, and in the course of one day, it went from 68 degrees to 32 degrees
right.
in about 7
yeah.
hours.
Right. Right.
So if that was my only data point, I would
yes.
have thought this was an extreme anomaly.
Right. Exactly. And that's the critical question, always in dealing with this. Are we looking at short-term or long-term variations
right.
and variations over time?
I have one of my colleagues.
Sure.
The tree ring records.
Yeah, in the Canadian Shield area, there are some
yeah.
good tree ring records that overlap this period of time that relate to summer temperature, which would be an excellent proxy record for
yeah.
evaluating, especially in a transect, say, from near shore context towards the interior.
Is that Shaw's data? Do you know the name on that?
I know that Marty Girardin has worked
okay.
with this.
Okay.
And there's tree ring records that Dave Staley has been working on that are further south
mm-hmm.
that can give you very high resolution records. They're the ones that plucked out the Jamestown drought, the Brotherhood
right.
Colony drought
right.
With their tree ring
right.
records. And I think you could actually get a slice through all of eastern North America.
Yeah.
And I think that would be very helpful in terms of
yeah.
understanding what's going on with
yeah.
tree sift, because
yeah.
amount of winter snowpack, how hot the temperatures get in the summer, combining I think will come out of those tree ring records.
Yeah.
At least provide you with a hypothesis that you can then go and look at your maps that were made the following summer and sort of see how they relate.
The other half of the climate center is actually located at Cornell. And the guy who's heading our project is a volcanologist, which is why Mount Tambora is kind of, you know, critical for him. We do have people or people in the climate area are looking at the tree ring records, but there's somebody, Peter Shaw maybe, who's up in Canada, has looked at tree ring records from, I can't remember exactly where, but someplace in Ontario, that we're supposed to get some raw data for him at some point. So that's great. Yeah, I appreciate that.
So I'm holding a proxy record.
Okay.
The results from the proxy record here is based on tree ring evidence. And from 1796 to 1825, there was 3/4 of a meter rise in sea level, or base level. Lake levels, and if you take the proxy as accurate, does 0.75 meters create enough? Or does it rise enough to make the high points in those islands?
You know, it depends if you'll. It depends.
Was part of that also doing an ice melt where that ice was perceived as land from a distance.
Right.
That's another way to turn the problem around.
Ron Schleifer and I have been trout fishing in New Zealand. And we've actually been in glacial water, practically up to our waist. And it's freaking cold. So the question, the question is, what kind of, especially if you're a fur trader, what kind of test are you conducting in terms of determining where land and water are? So Chris's point about hugging the coastline is a great point. The question is, what do you consider a coastline? If you're, for example, if a coastline is kind of breaking, melting kind of ice, you can't see tree branches under the ice and whatnot, you're going to stay some number of feet or some number of meters out from that. So I think that this is there's an epistemological problem here with precisely that. I would think 2 feet of water or 2.5 feet of water would significantly alter a kind of subjective perception of where solid land was. And also in terms of, ice and trying to determine depths of water. A canoe has a very shallow draft, but if you have open water, if it's a nice day, and to your right as you're going along, as you're canoeing along here, is there any point in like determining where exactly the land ends and where the lake begins? So I think that, on the coast of Maine, the city of Portland, or Maine, my half-year home, is now taking official precautions to against rising sea levels. Okay, the city is actually designating money to deal with that over the coming 30 years. And it turns out that, the engineers are saying 1 or 2 feet of sea level rise in Portland or in regions of Portland will have enormous effects, undermining buildings, undermining foundations, creating problems for bridges that barely clear the water, eroding beaches. There are all sorts of things. So I would think, as I think about these questions, I think 2 feet would probably be registered by a trader who's going back and forth multiple times. Now, if it's a trader who's keeping a journal who's never been past Manitoulin Island, who knows? But I would think that I would register a meter rise or a 3/4 meter rise or a 1/2 meter rise in lake levels. I think that would be significant.
Is there anything in the personal journals for folks who are traveling that a lot about changing conditions?
Ice. ice seems to be a thing, and first of all, nobody's ever bothered to, you know, catalog these things. So we're having to go from one source to another source to figure these things out. This guy Wingfield was pretty experienced and had some scientific instrumentation with him. And he was seemingly surprised by the extent of the ice out on the lake.
You know, you guys did a digital elevation model of Manitoulin Island, stuck it into a GIS, and
yeah,
raised and lowered your water.
You
can see what different configurations of the island look like as you move.
Again, we,
and
you know,
you
we
match it up with.
That's one of the things we, you know, we want to do. The problem is there are records of a lot of topsoil being laid down on the island, which is going to affect, you know, any kind of sense of what the, you know, what the level of water is. I think. I mean, there are apparent.
You have to put a lot of topsoil on to make your digital elevation models irrelevant, though.
That's what I thought. But they we heard anecdotally that they were dumping like truckloads of topsoil right after World War II on top of granite. To turning them into arable land. There are now farms that were rock shelves before. At least that's what we've heard anecdotally. I mean, I tend to be skeptical. Someone else?
I think the subjective experience of the depth of the water and the change in the island that you mentioned is probably key. And I'm wondering, when you get the bigger sample size of maps, of course, you have to get, I guess, fairly a large number. But if you could combine the proxy data with the sort of ANOVA that you could do with the islands versus the coastline surface area, it's a sort of a MANOVA that sort of determines what sort of level of statistical significance there would be for a difference in water depth that could change those perceptions in the cartography.
Yeah. And then I think that's a great idea. I mean, our goal ultimately, and it would be have to be a larger grant, is to ascertain how many maps we're talking about and what the ultimate data set would be. And we would want reputable cartographers who, for example, put neat lines at the bottoms of their maps. Then we might have a better sense. I mean, of what are statistical, you know, bases. I think I'd be willing to guess that we're still going to find these wild variations, seemingly, in size of the lakes. And if we get a refined algorithm that can do, you know, a pretty good job of measuring, you know, the size of the island versus the size of these islands, we might be able to infer something for that. I don't think we're ever going to hit a point where we can draw a one-to-one correlation between maps and geospatial data as we now understand it, or even proxy data. But what we can, you know, from a kind of, from a humanities point of view, I mean, it seems to me that what we've done is we've isolated a set of questions, which then become valuable for what climate scientists are interested in. And, you know, from our point of view, the fact is that once one comes away from staring at these maps or these digital images of maps, you know, you could write a 25-page article on each of these maps in terms of their kind of anomalous depiction of coastlines and so on. My expertise tends to be in East Asia, and in maps of East Asia, this kind of shading, and I presume that this is convention, is indicative of water depth. Now, what looks to us pretty random, for example, you can see that there's a kind of unshaded area in here that seems to go across there. You know, I don't think that we pay that much mind. Or you can see that here the shading doesn't come, you know, is not nearly as deep as that. I suspect that in many cases that may actually be a good faith attempt to indicate something about water depths. But water depths are subjective. You know, as Chris was saying, when you go from canoes, which, you know, basically skim the surface of the water, to steamboats, which have much deeper drafts, you have all sorts of, you know, kind of problems, as we know from reading, you know, Life on the Mississippi, right? But I think that there, you know, that there are ways in which these maps make, you know, good faith efforts to do things like show you, even though Carey seems to have removed a lot of these islands, to show you a kind of passageway through, you know, north of Manitou to Manoa Island.
It's also, though, stylistic.
Yeah, sure.
That's just the way they drew coastlines, and you remove that sort of shading, and then it's hard to tell whether you're talking about a coastline or just a river, right?
Though, right.
In other words, the outlines of the lakes wouldn't be nearly as clear without that. But there's also, I'm thinking about just something that you said earlier, and this, if you look at the Carey and the Russell maps, there's kind of a paradox here in that the more information they get, the less accurate they are, in the sense, right? So
exactly.
You look at the Carey map, he doesn't care about the islands along the Georgian Bay coast, and he doesn't care about Manitoulin Island either. So there's a lot less information in there. So he's just drawn Manitoulin Island as this sort of hammerhead shark-looking thing. And then you look at Russell's map, and he's taken more time to put in all of these islands.
Right.
So he's taken more time to detail Manitoulin Island, and in the process he gets it wrong. Only because we know Manitoulin Island is one island, not a series of islands. And part of the trick here might be trying to think about how Russell and then Arrowsmith are actually more accurate in another sense. Right,
so
they may be slightly wrong in that they have a series of islands, but more accurate in that they do have a whole lot of inlets and bays and low-lying area in Manitoulin Island. So what do we use to measure, you know, accurate and inaccurate?
Yeah, and that was my point about the, you know, epistemological status, right? You know, like, what counts as this or what counts as that?
And the question is, though, what can you say that's computationally significant? I mean, is a real question for computer scientists. And, you know, what we'll do in the future is, you know, isolate, you know, a region like this and see, you know, and see exactly what we mean by accuracy and inaccuracy.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the problems here is, of course, you know, we're now reading these maps as you look at them as kind of, you know, amateur art historians or as humanists, all of us, regardless of what our disciplines are. So we have a sense, I think Chris is absolutely right, that clearly Russell and Arrowsmith are trying to do the best job they can to render a complex coastline. On the other hand, there are kind of weird, you know, sort of anomalies here that would indicate that their attention seemingly wanders. I mean, look at this kind of shape of, you know, Lake Huron. I mean, what are they suggesting? And the question that I think that the digital humanities can actually help us with is, are these kind of variations statistically significant? What exactly does this inaccuracy, you know, tell us other than, you know, kind of, you know, bad map making? I mean, this is, you know, these are not bad approximations, and you can see what, you know, what the lake looks like here. That is not a bad map, you know, in terms of some overall sense of accuracy. But the question is, how do you measure accuracy? And now we're going to have to look, I mean, when you start, you know, breaking down a lake into constituent elements, here, for example, you can be running this algorithm on high-performance computing till the cows come home. You know, the lake levels rise or you know, lower again, or the next volcanic eruption. So.
You've got a DEM. Sorry.
Yeah. No. No.
On the DEM. No. It's, if you have a DEM of the entire lake.
Yeah.
That's supercomputing facility, they could test whether, or they could view what the coastline would look like if you drop sea level a meter, 2 meters, 3 meters, and then run it in the reverse direction.
Yeah.
And under any one of those scenarios,
do all three of these hold up?
Right. That's a great question. I mean, that's basically, in a sense, what we're going to be looking at to do with the, you know, with the next, you know, with the next round of grant applications, you know, to give us some baseline.
Well, speaking of the grant application, and this may be a very simple-minded question, it probably is, right. But you mentioned that there were different parts of this grant. Like one, you know, you guys are looking at maps, yeah. Somebody else is looking at quilts, someone else is looking at medieval right. manuscripts. What's the connection?
The algorithms, basically. And what the medieval manuscript people were doing was shape analysis, which is related to this. That article that I... Going back... Sorry. I actually like, you know, some of these maps are fun to look at. If you go back and look at this article in First Monday in May 2011, it'll tell you exactly what we were looking to do with the Common Grant. So these are basically, this is the team at Illinois that was actually using these collaborative infrastructures, which means not only people, but can you find something that's computationally deployable across sets of varying data, two-dimensional artifacts? So to interest the NSF, you can't just develop an algorithm that reads 17th or 18th century maps. That might be interesting. It's not going to get funded. So what we did with this kind of demonstration size grant, which in the humanities looks like a pot of gold, but for the NSF it's, you know, pocket change, was to come up with something that could be deployed across a variety of data and yield kind of, you know, interesting results. Ron, and then...
I just wanted to come back to Chris's question about accuracy, because this is one place the humanities can bring some tools to this study. In linguistics, we have... Maybe you all know, we have the opposition between marked terms and unmarked terms. And marked terms have more information than unmarked terms. On the other hand, unmarked terms lend themselves to generalizations more. One charts example is man versus woman, where woman is the marked term, there's more information, and man is the unmarked term that can be used to stand for humanity as a whole. And that question of accuracy in terms of information versus accuracy in terms of generalizability is interesting in terms of how to read these maps.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to this Hennepin map because it's a great question about, you know, looking at lake levels and so on. If you look at this map, I mean, this looks exaggerated to us because we know that the shores of Lake Michigan, for example, you know, around Evanston do not look like this. You know, they're quote-unquote smooth. However, from the point of view of somebody who's out in a canoe, looking for places to camp, you know, one night to the next, looking to get through as fast as possible, you know, where any kind of inlet from those, you know, winds coming off of the coming from the northeast, all of this thing can constitute a kind of inaccuracy that nonetheless provides a great deal of use value in terms of information. Where to put, you know, where to pull your canoe in, you know, on, you know, when a June night or a July night suddenly turns, you know, freezing cold. Well, gee, it says on Hennepin's map, we've got this island here. Maybe we can, you know, either get to the shore of this island or there. So this looks to us inaccurate by a standard manner, but it could be, as Ron says, it could be the kind of mark term that we're looking for, places that you can beach a canoe.
I was wondering about, you mentioned we could develop an algorithm just to deal with the lakes, but that's not going to get funded. So we need to develop an algorithm that has more general...
Yeah, I just do what the computer scientists tell me.
Well, you know, I mean, this was, I wondered if in your conversations with the computer scientists, if they had expressed any frustration that this, while this algorithm is generally applicable to all three of these things, it might work better on one thing, or it would be possible to develop an algorithm that would work better to your specific task.
That's a great question. So what I have to actually write a small grant application for Monday, but I was meeting with Peter Bashy's successor at the NCSA, and we have more computing power than we have interesting problems to deal with. And the problem is framing the interesting problem so a computer scientist is interested in it. And so the computer scientists are like fascinated by the idea of making in a sense, tweaking the algorithm or creating another workflow that would just look, for example, for island shapes and measure those accurately and coastlines and not worry about the square mileage there. That would, in effect, draw a kind of dotted line around here and then measure that. Then there are questions about could we get inside the islands and measure the size of the islands so that algorithm 4 might determine where islands were, but algorithm 5 would automatically start, judgments on the size of islands. Can we get higher digital resolution versions of maps? I mean, one of the frustrations that I have is nobody pays to digitize maps. This is done on a kind of half-assed, come-as-you-can basis. So the University of Illinois has more maps of Michigan and Illinois and those lakes than you can imagine, but nobody's digitized them, and there's no budget specifically to digitize these. It's kind of on a need-to-digitize basis. So you have to try to write a grant to digitize the maps to then make the maps computationally significant, which is why this David Rumsey collection is so
valuable. Because they're so detailed.
Yeah.
You need to sell this to Google.
Well, I've gone to a number of computer conferences, and I mean, talking to Google is like, you get your 3 minutes, with your petition in front of the king,
it's like lobbying Congress, yeah. Is what you're saying.
Oh, much worse. No, I think, first of all, Google has more money than Congress. Yes. So, I mean, that's the thing. They're interested in these kinds of questions, but I think that there's a real role for figures like David Rumsey, who's this remarkable figure, who's making these maps available online. You have to search through the maps more or less by hand. So one of the things and this is why this has to be a multidisciplinary project, you need to have really a graduate student in the humanities as well as one in the computer sciences who can look at this, this map and say it's got the right resolution, it's really interesting, it does something, let's grab this map for our data set. Whereas there are a number of other maps which are less resolution, and if you send a computer science student out to get any maps of the Great Lakes, you'll get kind of grab bag. So I think that kind of critical problem is who you're interesting and what kind of information you can generate from it. So
this is nitpicky. I'll just begin with that. So take it with a grain of salt. But in your graphs where you're showing the correlation of measured surface areas by satellite.
Which particular?
Well, in all of them. So one of the problems that mappers have had is projecting a coordinates on a curve,
right,
surface onto a two-dimensional plane.
Going back to Mercator, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. And I wonder, are these corrected in their algorithms? Did they correct them for the...
I believe that they did. Okay. The blue line, which is the actual lake size as we know it today, that is corrected. Those are U.S. Geological Survey data there.
And I just thought maybe that might help to resolve some differences.
You look at some of these things and, a situation like the French here, are very, very close to an accurate measurement of Lake Huron in the middle of the 18th century. But then there are other French maps, I mean, which are, you know, doubling the size, you know, almost doubling the size of the lake. Are these guys just nuts? Are they registering, you know, something? And also, you know, what makes me really kind of intrigued, and we may extend our maps up to 1860, is you look at this cluster of British maps in the 19th century, which are, you know, off by a significant factor in terms of the square mileage of the lake. Was the lake actually smaller? Did it seem smaller? Were there places that sandbars blocked access, or granite, you know, protuberances, you know, just sort of blocked access to?
Or another explanation might be the same reason that the Bermuda Triangle story propagated was because one writer took the writings of a previous writer who didn't do any research and repeated them.
Yeah.
And so are these cartographers building on each other's?
You know, I mean,
one bad map and everyone else copied them.
Well, see, the problem is what we figured out is that would make sense if you were reading, you know, through the years, you know, so that this guy could have been copying this guy, this Frenchman, okay? But here you've got a number of maps all at the same time, and this is a significant, variation. I mean, you're off here by, 5,000 square miles, you know, so that these kind of clusters here suggest that there's not, you know, I think that just, again, subjective eyeballing. Yeah, sure.
I think that's another area where humanities people research kind of comes in, right? Because when you start to look into the circumstances of those mapping of those maps, then some of those variations, there may be. Is there a way to do not just the scientific the data, but also the circumstances of the mapping expeditions? Who were they? Who did it? Where did they go? When did they go?
That's a good question. It looks like almost all the maps integrate multiple data sets. So it's not that they're relying on one trader. Also, map making is a highly lucrative and competitive business in the 18th and 19th century. So that people are trying to, in every single atlas that you look at, has kind of advertisement, new and improved, most accurate data, the true representation of again and again and again. So if we look at Cary in 1806 and that weird shape of Lake Huron, we look at the French and Indian War map, I mean, there's clearly, you know, different data sets at work. Hennepin in 1701, Lee to Hennepin. You know, there doesn't seem to be this kind of set of copying maps, which I think we would tend to
want to see. What about copying, but sort of collating? I've got 10 maps, and okay. I'm going to resolve these changes.
If I had my computer, I'd show you this China stuff. The Blau Atlas in the 17th century is the most expensive book produced during that time. If you ever have a chance to see a Blau Atlas up close and personal in a rare book room, you should do so. It is absolutely filled with hundreds of maps. The Dutch actually used the Blau Atlas as a presentation gift to foreign monarchs. Okay? There's a guy named Janssen, who's often transliterated in English in England as Johnson, who's publishing maps at the same time. And, you know, the Blau Atlas was kind of the Mercedes-Benz dealership, and the Janssen was kind of the Hyundai dealership. And they were producing basically knockoff maps of the Blau. And there you can see influences fairly clearly. And you can also see differences in quality. So my intuitive sense of looking at cartography is, you know, that these really are being drawn based on what they consider new information. The cartographers have their reputations online, okay? And so, in a sense, you know, for Hennepin to just say, well, there's, you know, there's Lee's map, I'm going to do the same thing, but put more information in and write in French, that's not where his ego is involved. His ego is dependent, and his professional reputation is dependent on the new, improved, most accurate map I can possibly get. And these things sold very well. Cartography was a big business. So, you know, if you were in Paris in 1705, you know, when you saw this Hennepin map, this would be, this is, you know, I think would be like a new, you know, PlayStation game. I mean, everybody would want to have one at the time. It sounds counterintuitive to us. And again, you know, we look at these maps and, you know, it looks like, you know, Hennepin was doing okay here, and then he dropped some acid, you know, and there's Lake Huron, and then, you know, his kid brother, you know, did Lake Erie, or the cat, you know.
Well, it seems that on the graph you had with the regression line with Lake Huron, it seems that if you look at that, I mean, I'm not statistical software, but if I were going to draw a line of best fit on that graph, which obviously would not be statistically accurate, but can you put up the Huron one?
Oh, I'm sorry, that's Superior.
I would have drawn it going from the top left corner down to the bottom right, where there's all these French people making increasingly inaccurate maps, it seems like.
Yeah, I think this is a regression analysis for the British maps.
It looks like it tracks the
British.
British.
Right. Well, but it just doesn't seem like they are copying each other, as you say, because they're just... And that seems to suggest the climatological argument that something is changing over time that is...
Well, there's one other possible argument. Can you flip through just a few of those and maybe pause 2 seconds on each one?
On the maps?
Yeah, no, on these regression analysis plots.
Sorry.
Just stare at the blue cluster around 1800.
Yeah.
It consistently underestimates the square mileage. That's the one outlier, but there's less data there.
Yeah.
There.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, again, we've got to get a larger data set. This is what we had to work with. But boy, that sure looks to me
lower lake levels,
more ice.
Or bad instrumentation.
You know, but these, you know, we keep...
I agree, the reputations are on the line.
The reputations are on the line. And also, you know, I mean, look, if we go for a hike in the woods... You know, we've got GPS systems and cell phones and
I wouldn't trust this thing.
Yeah, you know, and everything else. But to go, you know, hiking in the, you know, to go off in a wilderness where like 20 other traders have gone last year, and you may not see another European or you know, for 6 weeks or 2 months until you get to a trading post. You know, I think that you're going to be attuned to your environment in ways that it's hard for us to think about. Roger, you here? Hmm? Oh, I thought you had something.
Well, I just want to say that maybe 5 more minutes, because I have to get to a department meeting.
This has been enormously helpful for me. It's great to hear these questions. And as I say, this is kind of a proof of concept sort of thing. Could we do the algorithm? Could we, you know, come up with, you know, couldn't we come up with anything? Can we get more refined algorithms to do more kinds of, you know, interesting analysis?
Yeah, this is a very sort of practical question that I just don't know the answer to. You mentioned that it costs about $50,000 to get the supercomputing done.
On a climate model.
How does that cost alter? I assume it goes down as computing capability.
Not really, because the problem with climate modeling, as I understand it, is there's more and more data all the time.
I wondered about
that's the problem. So we have a couple people at Illinois who are part of that IPCC team that shared the Nobel Prize. Okay. And, you know, what excites them is, for example, better measuring devices to measure ocean temperature. Because ocean temperature, the real big weakness in climate models is you can't measure ocean temperatures at like 3 mile intervals. You know, you have to do an average of like, you know, tens of thousands of square miles. And so there are new satellites that are giving us more accurate mapping of ocean temperatures. But then when you plug those in, you're often raising the stakes in the computing by an order of magnitude in terms of the sophistication of the models.
You want it processing so much more data that processing set.
If you're ever in Champaign, Illinois, there's the Blue Waters Project there, which is the first accessible petascale computing facility in the world. I mean, the military and the Japanese have petascale computing, but, you know, they're doing trillions and trillions of calculations a second. And the climate scientists don't think that that's enough data. I mean, they, you know, they want to, you know, they're always asking the computer scientists about quantum computing and, you know, all sorts of things. But the climatological modeling is sort of fascinating. And as a historian, I get very, very curious looking at these, you know, looking at these maps and looking through journals and trying to figure out what's going on. I can't point you to places in the 18th century where, I mean, James Cook's first voyage is a great example, where the officers are standing around on deck. They're sailing down towards Antarctica looking for Terra Australis Incognita, and they're debating about whether they're looking at ice or land. Okay, they're debating about whether they're looking at ice or land. And that's something that we've kind of completely sort of forgotten about. My guess is more ice, lower lake levels is probably, wherever the regression analysis was. You know, if I had to, you know, put money on something, this sure looks to me like more ice cover, which would tend to, you know, lower lake levels a bit.
So you get the two effects at once, yeah. Ice sticking out into the water and the water level being,
so they don't know where the shoreline is, so they're underestimating.
Exactly. Right, they're really underestimating.
Yeah. You know, when you get more maps and plug this in, what would be great is if what emerges is more clusters.
Yes.
And then you can focus on the clusters,
right.
Then you start saying, well, why is it at this time, you know, they were all here? Is it because they're all copying one bad map, or is it was it a weather or a climatological event or something like that?
Okay, I hate to cut this short.
Listen, thank you. This has been great for me.